This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
Why are all the Kiwis getting out? Because it's been massive news in New Zealand, a new record recently being set for the number of people leaving New Zealand. A lot are coming here. Why? G'day, it's Dave Marchese. Coming up on Hack, we speak to the Kiwis who now call Australia home.
I was making more as a dishwasher than I was for my local council that I was working for back in New Zealand. So if that doesn't say anything, I don't know what does.
Yeah, hearing a lot of these stories, if you're a New Zealander who's moved to Australia, I want to hear what decided it for you. And is it short term? Do you always think, yeah, I'll go back eventually, or you reckon you're here for the long haul? 0439757555. Also coming up, Donald Trump's plan for Gaza gets the tick from the UN Security Council. But what does that mean? We'll fill you in. First, though.
Hack.
Why is it that men are having an existential crisis around losing hair? Because there has been status assigned to still having hair. That hair loss is associated with weakness.
On Triple J.
Yeah, just a warning, this story that we're going to cover now talks about depression, suicide, and something a lot of men go through but are too embarrassed to talk about is hair loss. It's not something that just happens when you get older. You can start losing your hair as a teenager. And while some guys accept their fate, they shave off all their hair, decide to embrace it, many, many others use medication to stop or slow their thinning. But some report side effects from these drugs that they're using, and maybe you're one of them. I want to know, did you stop your hair loss treatment because of side effects? Message in 0439757555, or maybe it was the opposite. You had a great experience. It really worked for you. Well, it's something the ABC's background briefing program has been looking into, and reporter Tynan King is with us now to talk about it. Tynan, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
What made you want to look into this story, like specifically hair loss drugs and side effects?
Anytime I opened my phone and went on social media, I would just see ad after ad spruiking hair loss medication. Now, they never said, you know, the exact drug that they were selling. They're not allowed to do that. But there were just dozens of ads, and I thought to myself, these are clever. You know, they'd have celebrities, they sort of talk about look good for the opposite sex, all sorts of things. I just kind of knew that this had reach, and like I thought it's worth having a look at.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem easier than ever before to get your hands on medication to help you with hair loss if that is what you're after. Often they're promoting very quick consults and stuff delivered straight to your door. What kind of medication is out there for hair loss?
The two main pharmaceutical grade, you know, scheduled for drugs are finasteride and minoxidil. There are even ads, for example, where, you know, one telehealth company will say, we all sell the same thing, we sell it cheaper. So they're the two main ones. And I looked at finasteride, which is one that actually can regrow hair.
And this one drug that you looked at, finasteride, is it sold under any other names?
It has brand names. Like the original brand name was Propecia. This was the company called Merck, a big pharma company, invented it in the 90s. But it's off patent now, so now they're a generic selling it. But they all call it finasteride, and it just has various names, you know, generic names.
So you started looking into this drug, the people who are taking it, who have reported side effects. What kinds of things were you finding? What kind of side effects were people reporting?
They call it, the guys who suffer this, you know, these bad reactions, they call it post-finasteride syndrome. And it's pretty broad, like there's physical side effects, like extreme muscle wastage. There's stuff like change to the shape of genitals, penis shrinking, all sorts of weird stuff like that. Then there's sexual side effects, low libido, erectile dysfunction, less pleasure when you have an orgasm, and neurological things like insomnia and brain fog. And then the really serious ones that I came across were anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation. These latter psychiatric side effects, I have to add, are rare, and most guys do tolerate this drug well, but they don't know why. Some people don't. And the other thing that's really curious about this story is these side effects can persist when you stop taking the drug.
Right, so people are saying they started to experience side effects, got off the drugs, and they kept having the side effect.
It gets worse when they stop the drugs. So on the forums, like I chatted to a few guys, you know, on Reddit and stuff like that, they call it the crash. And so they think at the time, okay, I'll just stop taking this drug. 5 days later, it'll wash out of my system and I'll be back to normal. But that's not what happens. A lot of the reporting was around, were these guys warned that there could be persistent side effects, persistent psychiatric side effects? So that's sort of the gist of the story.
So you talked then about some of the side effects that people have reported on some of these forums or on Reddit or wherever, saying, this happened to me. What are the official side effects that consumers are warned about?
Some of them are the same. So the sexual side effects like low libido, erectile dysfunction, those sorts of things are explained to people. In different jurisdictions, you get some of the psychiatric side effects explained. So, you know, in France, for example, there's a black box warning label on the packet of finasteride and it says may cause suicidal ideation. But in Australia, the psychiatric ones were missing. And I actually applied through one of these telehealth companies to get it just to make sure of that. You know, I had been told it by lots of guys, but I wanted to make sure it was true. And so I went onto one of the websites and, you know, did the questionnaire. It takes 5 minutes and you can do it from your home. You don't have to go anywhere. The doctor called me and this doctor did tell me about low libido, erectile dysfunction, also possible mood changes. But the, you know, suicidal ideation, depression and those things weren't mentioned.
You spoke with quite a few men for this story, Tynan. One of those was Angus. What was Angus's experience?
So Angus, he was a guy in his mid-30s. He was like running a pretty good restaurant in Melbourne, you know, like at the kind of top of his game, I guess you say. And then he gets on this drug for only 5 days and starts to get sexual side effects. So he stops. Then he has that crash and he has a real cascade of symptoms, you know, anhedonia, which is this weird thing where you can't feel joy and emotion and excitement. He says it's like, you know, if you won the lottery, you wouldn't even be happy. And he gets depression and suicidal ideation too. And so Angus said it just had a massive, massive impact on his life. He ended up actually, you know, going backwards in his career, back to essentially washing dishes.
It's just been the most significant thing that's ever happened to me, without a doubt, without a doubt. And it's not really an hour of the day that goes by without me thinking about it in some capacity.
Yeah, you're hearing from Angus there. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese chatting with ABC Background Briefing reporter Tynan King about his story looking into the side effects of one hair loss treatment drug. We're hearing from you on the text line now. Someone says, I've been using topical medications which significantly reduce the side effects. Honestly, I'm pretty happy with how things are going. Another person says, I started losing my hair when I was 21 and decided to shave it off. I got terrible remarks when going out to nightclubs, but I've learned to love myself. Men need to stand together on hair loss. Rory says, my dermatologist warned me of the side effects from oral medication for hair loss. I've been using a topical treatment instead for 18 months and it's working well. And then someone else just says, my brother was fully bald at 17 and it's affected him. He's always struggled with confidence. It's really interesting, Tynan, because we're hearing from so many people who have experienced this much younger than their 30s, like Angus. Does sound like this happens to people at all ages.
That's right. There's a guy in the story called Andre. He was early 20s, many guys in their 20s. And the other thing you hear of people, like they're not in my story, but people who are, you know, 18, 19, 20, because some guys, you probably remember, like there are people in your high school when you're in year 12 who are already going a little bit bald. And they're seeing the ads on social media too. And one of the things that the companies do is they say, like, you've got to get ahead of it. You know, act early before it becomes a problem.
Is there any idea how common these side effects are? Because I know it's stated, like in your story, and medical experts say for the majority of users, finasteride is safe and effective.
It's very rare. The whole thing is contested and there's really not enough science done at the moment. You know, Merck, the company that invented this drug, they will say like less than 2%. There are studies and researchers who say it's more than that, but it is rare, is I guess the overall consensus. On the WHO, the World Health Organization's website, there's 26,000 adverse reaction reports And, you know, there are probably tens of millions of people on this drug, so it's definitely rare. But the thing to know is they don't know who will react badly. So there's no way to say prior to getting the drug, you'll be fine, because they don't actually know why it is some men react badly and others don't.
A lot of people think there should be a lot more research into this drug, similar drugs, side effects. What are experts saying? Like, you've spoken to professors here in Australia. What have they had to say?
The gist of it is, because the drug's off-label now, the company who invented it, Merck, they're unlikely to pay for clinical studies or do, you know, serious post-market surveillance on side effects. There is a push by the guys who have this post-finasteride syndrome mainly to get clinical studies up and running. There seem to be quite a few happening around the world. Nothing is like at the point where, you know, they're publishing results.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about telehealth, because some people have a real concern with how accessible these drugs are, right?
Yeah, so I spoke to Dr. Barbara Mintzes. She's a research scientist at the University of Sydney. She sort of studies pharmaceutical policy. That's her sort of area. And she said it just makes it too easy to get these drugs, and that it bypasses some of the important safeguards that we have in place.
It's bypassing the need for you to have an appointment where you're with the doctor and the doctor might say, you know, actually, it looks like you have quite a good head of hair. Is this really the right choice?
And to be clear, Tynan, like, you know, other health authorities around the world are being very transparent with warnings and information about possible side effects.
That's right. The FDA, which is the health regulator in the United States, it said that 1 milligram of finasteride, which is the common dose for hair loss, can lead to depression. The European regulator, which looks after the, you know, all of Europe, has said the same thing. And then really recently, the French regulator went further than the European regulator and said that the risk-benefit safety profile of the drug is unfavourable. So basically they're saying that because this is a cosmetic drug and these rare but serious persistent side effects are so severe, then it's just not worth it. And I asked the TGA about this. They said they're looking into it, but that they review things like this through an Australian lens, so they don't just, you know, jump on board what the US or Europe does. I should just say one more thing too. In the story, I find that some of the labels, it's called product information and consumer medicine information. So this is what you'd find on the leaflet in a drug packet. I found that some of them were actually out of date. They hadn't been updated to include some of the new side effects that, you know, people and experts have figured out do occur. And so there's an investigation into that as well. So they might be updated in the near future.
It's really interesting stuff, a fascinating story, worth a listen on the Background Briefing podcast. You can grab it wherever you listen to podcasts. Also read this story on ABC News Online. Reporter Tynan King, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, mate. Have a good one.
And we've got messages coming through. So many. Someone says, I was prescribed finasteride by my doctor, took it for a number of months. It did nothing for my hair loss, but it did cause tomato face. Another person says, we really just need to get rid of aesthetic value and societal expectations that they're putting on men. Someone else, gentlemen, embrace the bald or get a weave. Man, weaves are incredible these days, that person says. That's interesting. Maybe we need to get onto that, do a story on that. And then someone else says, I'd stopped my hair loss medication for a few reasons. I just didn't want to be on medication anymore and just got to a point where I didn't care as much about my hair loss. Look, if this has raised any issues for you, remember Lifeline is always there, 13, 11, 14. Also, I should say that Tynan did ask for a comment from one of the telehealth companies, Eucalyptus, and he got a response back, the clinical director there telling him all its patients go through a really comprehensive consultation with a practitioner before a prescription is granted, and adding that they would welcome any additional guidance on addressing emerging clinical concerns from Australian peak bodies or regulators.
Hack.
And breaking news, the UN Security Council has approved a US plan for Gaza.
On Triple J.
Yeah, you might have seen this in the headlines. The United Nations Security Council approving a plan for an international force in Gaza. The next step in ending the war for good. Outlining a plan for a future independent Palestinian state. Despite a vote to approve the plan, though, not everyone is on board. Both Israel and Hamas have rejected the resolution. So what's going on? Well, with us to explain, April McLennan.
May those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2025/748 please raise their hand.
More than a month since the ceasefire in Gaza, the world is backing in a plan for the future.
Those against?
In New York this morning, our time, the UN Security Council voted on it and the resolution sailed through.
The result of the voting is as follows. 13 votes in favour, 0 votes against.
China and Russia sat the vote out, but everyone else endorsed it. US Ambassador to the UN, Mike Waltz, reckons it's a significant moment as the world lines up to back Donald Trump's 20-point Gaza peace plan.
Thank you to the council members for this historic and constructive resolution, for joining us in charting a new course in the Middle East for Israelis and Palestinians and all the people of the region alike.
So, what does the approval of this plan actually mean? Well, it's the crucial next step for the ceasefire, following 2 years of Israel's invasion of Gaza and its campaign to crush Hamas. The approval of the plan means an international stabilization force is now authorized to provide security in Gaza. The US says multiple countries have now offered to contribute to that.
We have all bound together, recognizing the urgency of the situation and for swift adoption to deny Hamas any opportunity to reconstitute and to ensure that the people of Gaza can be fed.
And Mike Waltz reckons this resolution is just the beginning.
Today's resolution represents another significant step towards a stable Gaza that will be able to prosper and an environment that will allow Israel to live in security.
We welcome these next steps and we continue to back in the ceasefire, which is so important to peace and stability in the Middle East.
Australia supports the plan, but not everyone else is stoked. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he opposes the creation of an independent Palestinian state, which he says rewards Hamas for the terrorist attacks on Israel on October 7, 2 years ago.
Our opposition to a Palestinian state in any territory west of the Jordan River. This opposition exists, is valid, and has not changed one bit. I have been rebuffing these attempts for decades, and I am doing it both against pressure from outside and against pressure from within.
A spokesman for Hamas also says the peace plan that the world just endorsed doesn't meet the demands of the Palestinian people.
Assigning the international force with tasks and roles inside the Gaza Strip, including disarming the resistance, strips it of its neutrality and turns it into a party to the conflict in favor of the occupation.
What is absolutely critical today is to understand that if the ceasefire has brought some relief because the bombardments have stopped, the children are still living in extremely dire conditions.
In Gaza, UNICEF reckons children are suffering, with dozens of schools damaged or destroyed and millions still displaced. There's also been heavy rain in the past few days, flooding the tents hundreds of thousands of people are living in. And with winter now here, this man says it feels like the world is forgetting the Palestinian people.
No one cares about us, no international organization, and the whole world doesn't see what's happening to us. Have mercy on the Palestinian people and the children of Palestine.
Hack on Triple J.
April McLennan reporting there, and obviously we'll keep you across any developments in that story. All right, we're going to move to New Zealand now. Actually, we're going to talk about why New Zealanders are moving here.
Hack!
I just always think that Aussies are the Anzac brothers, you know. It's cool to come over here and just sort of share countries, and it's nice to be here.
On Triple J.
Kia ora whānau. Just grabbing my jandals, got me togs, and the cheleben. How was my attempt at that Kiwi slang for you? Not great, I hear the nation respond. Look, I'm talking about Kiwis, Kiwi language, Kiwis in general, because there's a record number of them coming to Australia right now. And we all know a New Zealander on this side of the ditch. Maybe you are one of them. I want to hear, why did you make the decision to come to Australia? 0439 757 555. It's something our reporter Alice Angeloni has been interested in. She's been chatting with a few Kiwis.
When I actually first moved here, I was working as a dishwasher.
Max is in his 20s. He's a Kiwi now living in northern New South Wales.
And I was making more as a dishwasher than I was as an environmental monitoring technician for my local council that I was working for back in New Zealand.
Max is part of what's been called a mass exodus of New Zealanders coming here to Australia.
We moved for a multitude of reasons, but primarily because the job opportunities in Aussie are way more abundant.
Sophie is 25 and originally from Mount Maunganui on New Zealand's North Island.
You get paid better, living costs are cheaper, so it just feels, and the weather's better, and the waves are better. Sorry, New Zealand. Love you.
Sophie and her partner Sam moved over this year. They arrived in February.
Job opportunities, friends and lifestyle.
I feel like it's been one of those things where when you're in your bubble and everyone's like-minded, you're drawn to doing similar things, and so everyone in our friend group is definitely exiting.
But turns out this shift is much bigger than Sophie and her mates. The latest data from Statistics New Zealand, that's New Zealand's equivalent of the ABS, shows a record number of New Zealand citizens left in the 12 months to September.
73,000 New Zealand citizen migrant departures is up 8% from the year before.
Brian Downs is from Stats NZ and says 29 was the median age of those who left.
If we look at 18 to 30 years old, that made up about 38% of all New Zealand citizen migrant departures.
So where are they going? Well, a lot come here. Data from March showed almost 60% of departing New Zealanders headed to Australia. And those here say it's a combination of cost of living pressures back home, which some feel like the New Zealand government isn't doing enough to fix.
I think the current government is really unappealing for a younger generation.
I'm not sure if that was a contributing factor to me moving, but I would say that it might be a contributing factor to a lot of other people moving.
As house prices increase and living costs increase, wages aren't increasing to match them.
The job of our government is to create the conditions that they can see a future here.
New Zealand's Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, spoke on this earlier in the year.
New Zealanders are actually working really hard, but despite how hard we work, we haven't fundamentally been able to change our standard of living. And that's been a 30-year problem.
But living across the ditch comes with challenges too, like not getting access to Centrelink. Jack is a Kiwi in his 20s living over here, but he's on crutches right now and can't work.
It's fine, I get it. Like, to go back home, stitch up, but at the same time, like, can't control the world, eh?
Kiwis living here don't have the same entitlements as the rest of us. For instance, they need to have lived in Australia for 10 years before they can access benefits like Centrelink or study payments. So Jack will head back to New Zealand to deal with his injury there.
Go home, hang with my mum, and she can look after me.
And then come back here?
Yeah.
What do you guys see as the biggest differences between New Zealand and Australia?
I mean, big ups to New Zealand for being way more supportive of our Indigenous culture. That's a huge thing that I miss about home.
The culture is what I miss the most. Yeah, love Aotearoa. I'd say the biggest difference is Australia's got heaps of squawky birds. Not the biggest fan. New Zealand's bird song, out of this world.
So what about the future? Do they see themselves here or heading home to Aotearoa? For Sam, he reckons Australia is feeling pretty good right now.
It's hard to say. I had always pictured myself to move home eventually, but now I'm here, I'm kind of like, I really like it here and I don't see myself moving home, like in the near future.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, Alice Angeloni reporting there and hearing from a lot of you on the text line now. Someone says, I'm Kiwi, moved to Melbourne in 2022. I own a house here, but I'm seriously thinking about going back to NZ because Aussies treat migrants so poorly. It's a shame to hear. Another person says, my brother-in-law and his family are in the process of moving over to Australia because there's not sufficient medical support for him. Essentially, he is a medical refugee, that person says. It's a lot of different reasons people are choosing to come to Australia. Another person just says, it's a bit better here in Oz. That's that person's opinion. And someone else says, I moved to Australia thinking I'd go back to New Zealand after working in the mines for a bit. I've now married an Aussie and I'm still here. Lifestyle and opportunity in Australia so much better than New Zealand. All right, let's dig into some of the economic reasons behind all of this a little bit more now with Dr. Asha Sundaram, a senior lecturer in the Department of Economics at the University of Auckland Business School, also a migrant to NZ herself. Dr. Sundaram, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
It is a great pleasure to be on.
How worried do Kiwis need to be about this brain drain from New Zealand, people leaving and going overseas?
Yes, we are hearing a lot about the brain drain in the news. As an economist, I would say that this is not a reason to worry. And that's for a few reasons. First, the global flow of talent to its most productive use is a good thing for the global economy. And secondly, Kiwis leaving often send back resources, not just capital and remittances, but also ideas and technology. And they often come back after spending time in Australia and other countries with new ideas that adds to the talent pool in New Zealand. Finally, New Zealand is getting skilled migrants from other parts of the world, particularly Asia. And I think that we should, as New Zealanders, focus on harnessing the talent that's coming in and the talent that is staying back in New Zealand.
Okay, that's interesting. So you're saying it's not all doom and gloom and people are coming back, and also New Zealand's providing the world with a lot of expertise in a lot of different areas. Would you describe this as a brain exchange? That's what we've heard from some people.
Yes, I am familiar with that term, a brain. I think the concern in New Zealand is that it is not a one-on-one exchange with Australia. In other words, we have a lot of New Zealanders leaving for Australia, but we don't see as many Australians coming back. That said, I am on board with the broad point of the idea of brain exchange, which is that talent flows globally. So it is true that we send people to Australia, but then we do receive talent from other countries.
Dr. Sundaram, a big reason that we've been hearing from Kiwis why they're leaving New Zealand are the low wages and the fact that they've stagnated. Why is this an issue in New Zealand?
That's a very important point. There is a lot of reflection right now in New Zealand on the cost of living, the low wages that makes it very difficult for young people starting out on their careers. One important reason is, of course, productivity. So New Zealand productivity is low in comparison to a lot of advanced countries, and there's a lot of thought being put into why that might be. Reasons being maybe we need to channel our resources better towards sectors that are more innovative. We need to increase competition in various sectors and also invest in our young people in health and education.
I understand that, you've probably looked into what needs to improve in the economy in New Zealand to entice people to stay. Well, what kind of things would we need to be seeing?
Definitely more investments in education, a higher focus on innovation. A lot of sectors, a lot of resources are flowing into, say, the housing market, for example, which is great. People do need a home to live in. However, it is not what we call a very productive asset. So perhaps looking at channeling resources into the right sectors that are driven by innovation would be one option.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with economist Dr. Asha Sundaram from New Zealand. We're talking about the brain drain or brain exchange or mass exodus, we'll call it that, from New Zealand to Australia. A lot of Kiwis getting out of their home country, settling here. Dr. Sundaram, one of the things that we're talking about constantly in Australia, especially particularly with young people, is housing affordability and getting young people into housing. What's the situation like in New Zealand at the moment for young New Zealanders?
Almost exactly the same. It is a real concern. Young New Zealanders are finding it very, very hard to get on the property ladder. Often it is almost impossible without support from family. As a migrant myself, I can say that it is an uphill battle because you don't have family in the country to support you in any way.
Yeah, as someone who has started a new life in New Zealand, how has the experience been for you? I'm keen to hear what that process was like.
Overall, it's been fantastic. I think New Zealand has a lot to offer migrants. It's a beautiful country. It is safe. The quality of life is phenomenal. We, of course, have challenges, though, ones we have talked about, which is buying a house is a very daunting task, not just for migrants, but for a lot of New Zealanders that were born here as well. And also just getting those productivity levels up. I'm glad to say that there is now a conversation around technology, boosting AI and leveraging it to increase productivity. So things are looking positive.
Okay, well, look, we'll try not to be offended that you chose New Zealand and not Australia to migrate to. Dr. Sundaram, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, David. It was a great pleasure to be on.
And we still have so many messages coming through. Someone says, I've been here for years, absolutely love it. I do find life better in Australia. Someone else says, I'm actually an Australian thinking of moving to New Zealand. So it's interesting hearing why Kiwis have moved to Australia. Another person says it's crazy that citizens and residents of Australia get a lot of benefits in New Zealand, but it's not the other way around. And then someone else says, as a politician in New Zealand once said, when a Kiwi moves to Australia, it raises the IQ of both countries. Take from that what you will. That is all for Hack for now.